This week's lecture is the Native American response, which isn't week 5 actually, it's week 7, I just noticed that. Come on. We are really in week 7. And you are all experts now on Native Americans before, because you're preparing for your little presentations on Thursday, have you not? Lots of blank looks. I'm really excited about them now. So I'm going to give you an illustration of two Native American responses to white settlement, and then we'll be hearing some contrasting attitudes from your presentations, I hope. So it's all about how Native Americans respond to white settlement in North America, the various responses, including, but not exclusively, violence and war, accommodation, you try and get along with these people, or running away and just leaving them and sort of thinking, I'm going to put as much geographic separation between me and those places as anywhere else. And all of these possibilities are tried during the 17th century. They're all experimented with. I think the problems that Indians had in North America is that they don't have any real concept of the world, or how big the world is, and how many other people live in the world. And they don't know if the number of white people who've arrived on their shores are the beginnings of a much, much larger migration, or are all there is. There've been lots of other white people who come to North America before the English settled there in the 17th century. The Spanish had been there, the French had been there, lots of fishermen had been there, but no one had been there for very long. Even at Roanoke, over the course of, say, 3 or 4 years, but that was it. And so, if previous encounters are anything to go by, then most Native Americans would have come away from the from them by thinking that these things don't last very long, they're temporary. White people come and go, they just, you know, wonderful lives, little mysteries, and all future encounters that we have with these people will also be temporary and transient. They don't know if it's going to be permanent in the future or not. So what I want to talk today about is what I describe as the Indian perspective, what a guy called Dan Richter has described as looking east from Indian country. American history tends to have a narrative of looking west from the east coast westwards. Well, think about it from the other point of view. Think about it as Indians looking east and seeing these white people come in. And so I'm going to talk to you about the Powhatan in Virginia and the Narragansett in New England. This map shows you the most dominant Indian groups in this period. We're going to talk about the Powhatan, which are at the bottom there, dominating the Chesapeake, and also the Narragansett, which I'll show you a blow-up map of the Narragansett, but basically they're in modern-day Rhode Island, the southern part of Connecticut. And also, if you haven't done already, this shows you where some of the tribes that you're going to talk about on Thursday are located. Okay? I've shown you this map before, haven't I? John Smith's map of Virginia in 1612, and the point I made about it a few weeks ago was that it shows you an Indian Virginia that's populated very heavily with Indians, and in fact the number of white settlements in Virginia is incredibly small. Most of those names on that map are Indian villages. And it's decorated with pictures of Indians. This warrior here is actually a Susquehanna warrior from that northern part of Virginia, on the Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania boundary, that sort of part of the country. And I think some of you are dealing with the Susquehanna, are you not? So, there you go, I've given you a picture of a Susquehanna warrior. Let's talk about Powhatan, his empire. Powhatan is basically a paramount chief, and it's called an empire rather than being a confederacy. It's not a it's not formally organised, it's very much more loose than that. He's basically an overlord, and he has vassal tribes, subject tribes, of which he is in control of, in charge of. And he doesn't govern them individually. They are not... I'm trying to think of the analogy. They're not like... like the colonies are in Britain, in relation to Britain. They are not governed directly from London or, you know, in that sense. These subject tribes effectively pay tribute and acknowledge Powhatan's overlordship, which is primarily a military overlordship, has to be said. And in return, he doesn't go and massacre them. So it's a bit like protection money. And that so long as they remain allied with Powhatan, then their lives are okay. He exerts the greatest control over his vassal tribes, the closer they are to his own settlement. And Powhatan's own settlement is very close to the site of modern-day Richmond, where in fact I was about 10 days ago. Because Richmond is where the James River has rapids or waterfalls. So it's, the James River is navigable as far as Richmond. And Richmond's probably 50 miles from Jamestown. So the tribes that are on the extreme coast, and especially that are on what's called the eastern shore of Virginia, that bit of the Chesapeake Bay that sort of sticks out south of Delaware, are only loosely associated with him. Sometimes they're not in alliance with him at all. There are some independent tribes in Virginia that aren't anything to do with Powhatan. And it's into this world that the English have appeared, that they've got to relate to Powhatan as the most important figure in the Chesapeake, the most important military and political figure in the Chesapeake. And he has lots of vassal tribes, which the English find difficult to distinguish between. But he also has some tribes which he's not, who aren't vassals of his, who are his enemies. And so the English are in quite a complex situation, and they don't really understand it for quite a long period of time. This is the picture of Powhatan. Again, I showed you this a couple of weeks ago. Showed in his ceremonial garb, his headdress, in his own little sort of meeting hut. If you think about what the English look like from Powhatan's perspective, they don't look that impressive. They are... very small group. Remember, the first sailing ships bring about 140 odd people. Some of the later ones bring a few hundred at a time, up to 900. But they're nothing in comparison to the sort of 10,000 people who are under his control. They're not a significant player in his worldview. They have some interesting concepts, they have some interesting weaponry. They're not ruled out of completely. But I don't think that Powhatan sees the English as a threat. these English people, they come and they live in their little fort. They may be spread out a little bit beyond the fort. But the one thing that they do very regularly is die. I talked about the high death rates in a previous lecture. So although they keep on coming, they keep on dying too. And that prevents Jamestown growing as a settlement to being a really important settlement. The best thing the English have, as far as Powhatan's concerned, is trade goods, especially metallic trade goods, because generally metallic trade goods are scarce in Native American society in the East Coast. They don't have weaponry, they don't have metal pots and pans, let alone earthenware things. So the weaponry and the metallic goods that the English have are valuable, and that's what he thinks they're useful for. He also thinks that some of this weaponry could be put to good use. He could use these new English people as allies against some of the other powerful tribes that are west of him, that have sometimes put him under pressure. So, what Powhatan does is he uses some of his vassal tribes, the ones that are much nearer to Jamestown, to conduct a variety of different types of relationships with them, with the English. They're not consistent, and I think what historians have sort of surmised is that Powhatan is sort of gauging the strength of the English. Sometimes he has, you know, very generous terms of trade, sometimes he has much harsher terms of trade, and he wants to see how the English react to various situations. So he's sort of probing, testing, being a bit cautious, but definitely he's like the puppet master behind what's going on with these vassal tribes. This is Powhatan's mantle, embroidered with shells, and this was given to the English as a gift, and it's now in the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. So if you're ever in Oxford, you want to go and see Powhatan's mantle, his cloak, then it's in Oxford. Made out of buckskin, and it's an important, impressive document. It showcases Powhatan's power, his wealth, his status. It's significant that he gave it as a gift to the English at one point, showing his control over them, perhaps exerting his control, his power over them. And this is a reconstruction of what an Indian home would have looked like at the time. Not that dissimilar to what John White painted in the 1580s. And I remember the picture which was shown you of Powhatan sitting inside one of those little huts. Well, this is what they look like from the outside. They don't look anything like, you know, wigwams or teepees, which are our stereotypical image of how Indians lived, which is much more of a Western phenomenon. The Plains Indians lived like that, but no, the East Coast tribes much more commonly lived in these sorts of homes. Both sides here are cautious. Powhatan knows from his vassal tribes who have been to Jamestown that Jamestown itself is quite well defended. There are many guns there. The fort itself is well constructed, it's solid, it has these earthenware ramparts, it has stakes, it has palisades, it has lines of fire, lines of sight. It's going to be hard to destroy Jamestown. And so for a lot of the early year or two, the Indians only visit Jamestown to trade. They're not in Jamestown very, very frequently. The problem the English have is having enough food to eat. And this is something that is constantly their problem in North America. They, the English don't think they have much to learn from the Indians. They certainly don't think they have to learn, you know, agriculture or hunting techniques from a bunch of what they consider to be savages. And therefore, they never gather and garnish enough food to survive winters. They're constantly hungry. They are always dependent on Indians for trading for food. And sometimes Indians aren't prepared to trade for food. And these are exactly the same issues that, remember, they had in Roanoke back in the 1580s. And sometimes white people kill Indians for food. One historian has written about so-called red peasants, whereby the English would hold off attacking a settlement until their corn was ripe or a hunting party had returned. Then they would attack a settlement, burn it down, and take all the food. And this historian describes them as basically using Indians as sort of a peasantry to grow crops of food and then take it as a lord of the manor would take it. You get quite a lot of violence over property and possessions. And that's partly because most Indian tribes don't have a sense of private property. All property is held in common. So, property that you say you've got pots and pans, well, they are used by people who need them They are not my pot, my pan. And so Indians tend to, if they visit English settlements, take things that the English then accuse them of theft, and there is a whole English tradition of harsh criminal punishment for thieves, which when this is applied to Indians causes outrage. You know, it's an offence against honour, it's an attack on the tribal honour, and therefore it has to be revenged, if somebody else has to be attacked and murdered and massacred because of it. And there's lots of issues there about private and public possessions. Certainly the English sanctity of property is something that is alien to most Native American peoples. Powhatan realises that the English haven't got enough food, that they are dependent on him for food. And when he sends food to them in 1607, in the first winter they're there, he, in a way, is doing it as a gesture of his own power and control over food. And when the English accept his gift of food, to Powhatan's mind, what they are doing is placing themselves in a dependent position. It's the whole notion of the gift and acceptance of a gift. What does that do to you? If you accept a gift from somebody, are you placing yourself almost under their control, or are you then therefore beholden to them? There's a whole literature about the gift, which, you know, maybe is worth exploring in this context. But to Powhatan, the English accepting this gift of food almost places them on as a new vassal tribe which have appeared in his domain. He is the one who controls them because he's the one who's keeping them alive. The English are very worried about that, and fairly quickly they begin to sense that Powhatan thinks of himself as in charge of them, and that they need to do what he says. And obviously they don't want to do what he says. And so in 1608 they try and crown him. They give him a crown, the idea being that if the English effectively anoint him or accept him as ruler of the Indians of Virginia, not of them, but of the Indians of Virginia, then he is putting himself in a vassal state to James I, who of course is King of England. And there's lots of issues about who does what to whom, whether the crown's accepted by Powhatan, whether it's not. There's lots of cultural misunderstanding here. But none of this eases the English dependence on the Indians for food, which is the long-running theme of Anglo-Powhatan relations in the early Chesapeake. By 1609, Powhatan has got all the sort of pots and pans that he wants, and the only thing he's interested in trading for food is guns, which the English are increasingly unwilling to trade for, partly because they need their guns themselves if they're going to hunt, but also they're worried that those guns are going to be used against them. They try and secure alternative food supplies, but they don't succeed, and that's because Powhatan's control over so many other tribes is absolute, in that they will not trade with them, and they will destroy food rather than allow the English to take it. And winter of 1609 is what I described a few weeks ago as the starving time, where the English numbers dwindle dramatically from 600-700 to only about 60 in the spring of 1610. And Powhatan is very close to destroying Jamestown in 1610, and he hasn't had to do very much at all. He hasn't had to physically go and destroy it. All he's had to do is starve them, and they're incapable of supporting themselves. And so the English are all but packed up and ready to leave in 1610 when a new fleet of ships comes with 900 new settlers and a new governor, Lord Delaware, to re-establish Virginia. And with this, among these 900 are quite a few new troops with better weaponry, the latest weaponry from Britain. And all this means that Powhatan himself doesn't exert anywhere near the control over the English in Virginia after 1610 as he had before 1610. the English are increasingly self-reliant after 1610. The English capture Powhatan's youngest daughter, Pocahontas, in 1613, and there's eventually a peace treaty in 1614, followed by her marriage to John Rolfe, an English planter responsible for the introduction of Trinidadian tobacco into Virginia. So it's like a peace treaty marriage. It's like one of these dynastic type marriages that you get in Europe all the time to secure a peace treaty. So-and-so's daughter marries so-and-so's son. There's quite an interesting story about the iconography of Pocahontas. This is the original drawing of her, and this is a later Elizabethan copy, 17th century copy, not Elizabethan. And the essentials are right. She's still holding the little feather thing. She's got the ruff, you know. But I think what's subtle is that they've sort of softened and anglicised her features quite considerably. In the original, she has quite high cheekbones, and she certainly looks quite foreign. Whereas here, she looks much more like an English woman. Even though she's dressed in both portraits in English clothes, her hat here is in white buckskin, which is very unusual in England. Again, the picture has been changed to black, which is much more traditional. A Pocahontas is one of the most painted or engraved figures of early Virginia history. She marries John Rolfe. She's renamed Rebecca. She's given an English name, Rebecca. She's taken to England to be presented at court, but she contracts, I think it's smallpox in England, and she dies, and she's buried in Gravesend in Kent in 1617. They did have one son together, a man called Thomas Rolfe, who was a planter in Virginia in the 1640s, so we know that they had at least one child, but what we don't know is what happened to him after that, whether he died, whether he ever had any children, whether that line, her lineage, ever continued. That's something we don't know. But certainly they did have one child together before she died at the age of 20. So you've got to a situation in the mid-1610s when relationships are reasonably stable. And that's partly because the English are being governed by the laws divine, moral, and martial, which, remember, really tight martial discipline where they prevent whites from trading on their own or having any contact with the Indians outside of official channels, which of course reduces the opportunity for tit-for-tat violence. And throughout this period, you know, the relationship is reasonably secure. And it's mainly a trading relationship that's pretty good. But Powhatan himself dies in 1618. He's succeeded by his younger brother, the 80-year-old, Opechancanough. And Opechancanough is a completely different kettle of fish to his brother. He's much more concerned with the English and their encroachment on tribal lands, driven, of course, by the demands of the tobacco plant, which is incredibly land-hungry. And this, of course, is driving the Powhatan away from where they've traditionally lived and traditionally hunted. Most of the Indian tribes in the Tidewater and the Chesapeake practice a sort of semi-nomadic lifestyle, whereby they reside in a particular village for a few years and then moved on, you know, perhaps 5-10 miles away and resided there for a few years. And therefore their crops grew, and then the land which they used was allowed to grow fallow for a number of years, and then it was used again. So, you know, they have sort of a territory in a way where they would move in between. But once the English come into it, then as soon as the Indians leave a place, the English believe them to have abandoned it, and therefore they take it for themselves as uncultivated territory, empty territory. And of course, then when the Indians come back and think, hang on a minute, you know, we were here 2 years ago, why can't we come back? You know, there's an English farm there, all fenced in. And this is also because Indian concepts of landholding are completely different from English concepts of landholding. English believe that you can buy and sell land. To an Indian, that concept is just bizarre, because to them, buying land is like, you know, buying the sea or buying the sky. You can't own land, you can't carry it around with you. Land is fixed. And so, land is held in common, and it's used by a tribe, but it's not used by individuals. So again, you've got this cultural difference that means that you can't square this circle. These interpretations are so completely different. You get a slow build-up of frontier violence over the next 3 years after 1618. And it all really comes to a head with the murder of a famous warrior, a man called Namatanyi, killed in November 1621. Opechancanough now organises all his vassal tribes to rise up on the same day, Good Friday, March the 22nd, 1622. And it's a very successful attack if you're an Indian. They kill about a quarter of the white population, about 350 out of a population of about 1,200. And Jamestown only escapes because some friendly Indian tribes, who aren't vassals of Opechancanough, warn Jamestown, and it's able to put up at least some resistance. It's very significant, the attack of 1622, because it allows the English to assuage their consciences for how the Indians have been treated. No longer are the Indians the noble savages, the sort of honourable owners of this this ancient land. They are just savages who need to be exterminated, and certainly a lot of English people are quite happy that that's the case. And for the next 10 years or so, the English and the Powhatan are at war. Opechancanough expects his massacre of 1622 to be decisive. If he'd destroyed a quarter of any other Indian tribe, they would have got the message pretty quickly and left. But what the English do is they reorganise, they regroup, they're well armed, they're well organised, and they attack each Indian village systematically, stealing food, destroying houses, destroying homesteads, and just massacring people left, right and centre. And of course, this now starts to put pressure on Indian food supplies, and Opechancanough's failure or inability to protect all his vassal tribes sort of weakens those ties of vassalage as well, doesn't it? The Indians haven't prepared for a long-term war. They haven't got stockpiles of food and weapons, whereas the English do prepare for that kind of war. And the English can always supplement their population by immigration, whereas the Indians can't. And for the next 10 years or so, the English and the Indians are at sort of a low-level war, until there's a truce in 1632, which sees a sort of clearing out of all the local Indian tribes near Jamestown. For about 10 or 12 years, things are fairly calm, until the third Anglo-Powhatan War of 1644 to 46. Again, Opechancanough, he's now over 100. I think he's 102 in 1644. Launches a coordinated attack, again on a Good Friday. He thinks that's an auspicious date, clearly. And he attacks all the plantations that he can find. But of course now, he's because there are no Indians near Jamestown itself, he's attacking the frontier areas, the edges of white settlement. And he kills 500 people. It's not an insignificant number. But the population of Virginia is so much greater in 1644, that proportionately it's a much lower proportion of the population. And he certainly can't attack as far inland as Jamestown. Opechancanough himself is captured and killed in 1646, and that effectively means the disintegration of the Powhatan Empire. And the treaty ending the war in 1646 redraws the frontier line of white settlement much further west. And although there are Indians left in the Tidewater area, They are no longer a united or concrete political force. They're all dealt with individually or separately. They are increasingly surrounded by whites and subordinate to the government of Virginia. And it's the origins here of this reservation system that becomes the norm in North America. And this shows you the situation increasingly in the 17th century. You've got things like Chickahominy as an independent group there in between the York and the James River. And you can see here, it's like, you know, the falls of the James, which is where Richmond is, and that was where Powhatan's own settlement was. But more and more land is being organised into white settlement. Although there are some remnants of the Powhatans after 1646, they're not that politically significant. They get sort of caught up in Bacon's Rebellion, but it's not really clear why, apart from the fact that the English like attacking Indians. The Powhatans themselves don't do anything to deserve it. There is some further reduction of tribes, probably most likely due to disease, and there's some merging of between tribes, and again, movement west is quite common. And by the 18th century, there are only two tribal reservations left in the Tidewater. Those are the Pamunkeys and the Mattaponies, both of which still exist today, actually, in between the James and the York rivers. But they are pretty small. The tale of the Narragansett is quite different, but in some ways the same, I suppose. It's a southern New England tribe. As I said, it was in modern-day Rhode Island. It's a large tribe, not so much geographically as in terms of numbers, probably about 30,000 members of the tribe. Wasn't hit anywhere near as badly as some of the other tribes, such as the Wampanoags, by disease, which were really devastated in 1610-20. Its main trading contact before the English arrived was with the Dutch in the Hudson Valley. Tries to ignore Plymouth after Plymouth was founded in 1620. And remember, the settlers at Plymouth ally themselves with the Wampanoags. And the Wampanoags, in a way, see the English as an ally against the Narragansett. So, the Wampanoags and the Plymouth settlers have a good relationship. I talked about Massasoit and Squanto in the previous lecture. And certainly Massasoit's not above using the Plymouth settlers and their military hardware against other Indian tribes, for example, the Massachusetts tribe to the north. But for most of the 1620s, the Narragansetts are left alone. And this area in green here is sort of the Narragansett homeland, where the Wampanoags have the sort of Cape Cod area, Massachusetts is that sort of pukey colour above it. But the Narragansett are a much more populous tribe than the Wampanoags, even though the Wampanoags have a lot more seem to have a lot more land. The settlement of Massachusetts from 1630 does inevitably impact on the Narragansetts. The Puritan settlers had a particular view of Indians. Some viewed them as potentially white, in that they could be converted, they could be brought into Christianity. They are perhaps one of the lost tribes of Israel who need to be enlightened as to Christianity. And some of the Puritans set out, you know, to sort of missionary work amongst the Indians. But they still have the same ideas of, you know, of savagery and the fact that whites and Europeans are better. And then we get the Pico War, which, although it's not against the Narragansetts, it does involve the Narragansetts. The Pico are a relatively small tribe because of disease. They'd only got about 3,000 members in the 1630s. They do seek some kind of alliance with the Massachusetts Bay Indians against the Narragansetts. And As a result, the Puritan authorities in New England start to suspect the Pequots are actually preparing for war against whites, whereas I think in reality the Pequots are really preparing for war against the Narragansetts. Now the Narragansetts are quite happy then to sort of join in with the English to attack the Pequots in the Pequot War of 1636-7, and the sort of massacres that ensue are, on one hand, they're sort of meeting a strategic aim of the Narragansett, but on the other hand, they are destroying another local Indian tribe, and in fact, the tribe is declared dissolved. The Pequot tribe is declared dissolved by the New England government in the 1630s. And this again shows you how the attack took place, coming down the Connecticut River and then coming round the coast and then attacking the Mystic Fort there of the Pequot. And the Narragansetts, of course, are just to the east. This is a contemporary drawing of what the attack on the Mystic Sea Fort was like, and it involved like the destruction of idols and things like that. But there was an initial sort of attack done by the whites in concert with the Indians and the Narragansett against the Indians, most of whom were asleep. It was very early in the morning. They attacked them, and then once the Indians were starting to organise themselves, started to resist. The white soldiers retreated out of the tribe, out of the thing. But as they did so, they set fire to all the homes. And as the Indians fled the fire, they shot them as they came out. And there's about 600 men, women, and children who were massacred just at this one particular fort by the English. And when you read the accounts of some of these settlers of this massacre, the way they glorify the bloodshed and say it's, you know, God's will, and God had given them the power and the ability to destroy their enemies like this, and the Indians might have called upon their gods, but their defeat shows them that the Christian God, the Puritan God, was far more powerful, and he had smote his enemies, and it's full of that sort of self-righteous language, and the sort of glorification of the butchery of these men, women, and children who were all put to the sword as they tried to flee. So I'd recommend, you know, if you want to get a sense of how Puritans viewed Native Americans, you might read, like, Mason's account of the Pequot War, which is linked off the reading list, because you'll get a good sense of just how horrible some of these white people actually were. So for most of the 1620s and 30s, the Narragansett have sort of remained distant. They remained a little bit aloof. And that's partly because they were a sizeable population, partly because they weren't really close to any key trade routes. They weren't on the Connecticut River Valley, they weren't in Massachusetts or on the coast, they were sort of tucked away in what becomes Rhode Island. And furthermore, they've got this leader, a sachem called Miantinomi, who befriends Roger Williams, and Roger Williams founds the colony of Rhode Island in the 1630s, 1636, I think. Although he participated, the Narragansett participated in the destruction of the Pequot, the Narragansett chiefs, especially Miantinomi, can see the writing on the wall here, and he tries to put together some kind of Indian alliance. But in 1642, Miantinomi himself is captured by the Mohegans, and they give him to the English. But the English find that they actually haven't got any laws that he's broken. He hasn't done anything against the English. They can't try him for any offence because he's not committed any offence. And so they give him back to the Mohegans to kill, which they, you know, oblige. And a couple of years later, mainly out of suspicions more than any other concrete facts, the United Colonies of New England, quote unquote, attack the Narragansett. And it's not a complete victory. It's not like the Pequot War. What you get is a war whereby the Narragansett surrender quite a lot of land strategically, but they don't get wiped out. And they mainly manage to maintain their independence because they ally themselves with the Mohawks. And the Mohawks are sort of in the west, close on the Hudson River Valley. and the Mohawks are a very, very powerful tribe, and the fact that the Narragansetts and the Mohawks are working in concert together means that they can gradually split off the whites from each other and break down this United Colonies of New England confederacy. King Philip's War, which I'll come to in a later lecture in the 1670s, is something that started by the Wampanoags. The Wampanoags, of course, remember being friends of the Plymouth settlers, but then this all goes pear-shaped by the 1670s, and it's the Wampanoag King Philip, son of Massasoit, who is blamed for the war. I mean, it's called King Philip's War, so that sort of tells you who they blame. But the Narragansetts get sucked in, partly because, again, for land reasons, and partly because the Wampanoags start out being quite successful against the English in the 1675 war, and the Narragansetts join in because they think it might be a successful war. But there's a major Narragansett defensive fort destroyed in December of 1675, with the loss of many of their key warriors, and the gradual displacement of the Narragansetts to the west, to sort of merge into the Iroquois after King Philip's War. And so their strategy of trying to remain aloof, independent, separate, hadn't really worked because of the growing population of whites in New England, which had continually put pressure on Narragansett lands. And they'd been unable to resist that land grab and those geographic pressures without violence, because peaceful protests didn't work. Going and speaking to the government of Massachusetts Bay or the government of Connecticut and saying, your settlers are crossing into our territory and settling there, met with absolutely no response whatsoever. And so when these things came to violence, then violence does get a response, but it gets a response on behalf of the settlers. And that's sort of a theme of Native American history for the next 200 years. Is that white armies go in to defend white settlers who shouldn't have been there in the first place. So, one thing I want you to think about, both out of today's lecture but also for the seminars on Thursday, is there an effective strategy? Was there a viable strategy that any tribe could have used? The Powhatan tribe war, the Narragansett tribe ignore, and neither of which work. Is there always going to be conflict between Native peoples, Native Americans, and Europeans, because they have such completely and utterly different mentalities, mindsets, worldviews? They have nothing in common. They're never going to get on because of that. What's the impact of trade? What's the impact of what's called the Columbian Exchange, whereby, you know, we get potatoes and turkeys and they get smallpox and syphilis? You've got things like the introduction of metal goods and metal working, which are advances technologically for Native American tribes. But then you get European demand for furs, which leads to overhunting and puts pressure on Native American food resources. So this is a key problem. And also, how important is war? Native Americans fight wars very differently from how Europeans fight wars. Skirmishes, short term, not long term, you know, total war, massacres, that sort of thing is not how Native Americans fight. And yet, you know, Europeans bring that type of warfare. So these are some of the ideas that you need to be thinking about when you're preparing for Thursday. When we'll learn about the strategies adopted by some of the other tribes in New England, in the Middle Colonies, and in the South to European settlements.